I've been in law enforcement long enough to know that some cases don't end. They just stop breathing. The air goes out of them, and all that remains is a silent echo. The JonBenet Ramsey case is one of those echoes, louder than ever 3 decades later, reverberating between fact and fiction, truth and myth. Every time I revisit it, I feel the same chill. A child murdered in her own home on Christmas night. A family crushed under suspicion. A police department in over its head from the very start. Tonight, we're going to dig into all of it and explore the latest developments in a case that refuses to die. This is Zero Signal Shorts. Remember to like, subscribe, and follow. And don't miss our full-length episodes every Tuesday at 6 a.m.
Most major American cities are ringing out the old year with the encouraging news of declining murder rates. But beyond those numbers are the people, the victims, who will not be ushering in the new year. Case in point, the unsolved case of a 6-year-old beauty pageant winner buried just today. Diana Olick has the story.
The body of 6-year-old JonBenet Ramsey was laid to rest in Atlanta today.
To be honest, the mind cannot grasp and the heart refuses to accept the death of one so young.
Friends describe her as luminous, a pint-sized beauty queen who in 1995 won the Little Miss Colorado pageant. Her mother, a former Miss West Virginia, and her father, president of a billion-dollar Boulder business, told investigators JonBenet was tucked safely in her bed Christmas night. But come morning, she was gone. Her mother called police saying she'd found a ransom note asking for $118,000. Hours later, with police in the house, the little girl's body was found hidden in the basement. Nearly a week later, crime scene investigators are still combing through the home. Police haven't named any suspects, but curiously, they are saying that the public at large is not in any danger, that there is not a random killer on the loose. Just 2 days before Christmas, the home was filled with friends for the annual Christmas party. It was the last time neighbor Joe Barnhill saw JonBenet.
He was just gorgeous and just beaming and so joyful with Santa Claus.
Bill McReynolds has been playing Santa at the Ramsey Christmas party for years.
She's the only child that I ever talked to and asked her what she wanted for Christmas that never said that she wanted anything.
The father, John Ramsey, has hired a criminal defense attorney, and police are not releasing the full results of JonBenet's autopsy. Only that she was strangled. Other evidence from the body, they say, is still part of the murder investigation. Diana Olick, CBS News, Boulder.
It began on the morning of December 26, 1996, when Patsy Ramsey called Boulder to police just before 6 a.m. She reported that her 6-year-old daughter was missing and that she had found a ransom note demanding $118,000. Now, this is an oddly specific number, and it matched perfectly to her husband's recent work bonus. As a former investigator, that number alone would have sent my instincts humming. And in real ransom cases, perpetrators demand round figures, $500,000, $1 million, not precise payroll figures known to maybe a dozen people. Right there, the circle of possibilities, the circle of suspects shrank dramatically because no one else would have known it. Officers arrived within minutes to the Ramsey's 3-story Tudor home at 755 15th Street, a mansion that was absolutely decked out in Christmas lights and family photos from the previous night's festivities. They expected to find a kidnapping scene, but instead, they walked into a house full of neighbors and clergy. The family had called them for comfort. No one from the department had the presence or the experience to lock down the crime scene. Evidence control failed before it even started. I've seen it happen. When panic takes over, the scene becomes a gathering place rather than a crime scene grid. Dozens of feet trample on what could have been trace evidence. Coffee was poured, furniture moved. One of the most important crime scenes of the decade became a living room for grief. The ransom note itself was a law enforcement officer's nightmare. 2.5 pages long, handwritten on paper from inside the home using a family's pen. It read like a movie script rather than a real extortion letter. We are a group of individuals that represent a small foreign faction. You know, this letter, it mixed threats with melodrama, even quoting cinematic language, phrases reminiscent of Dirty Harry and Speed. That's not how professional criminals write. A genuine kidnapper doesn't linger in a house long enough to find a pad, write multiple drafts, leave a 3-page manifesto. The note's content suggested staging, someone trying to divert attention to create the illusion of a kidnapping after something else had gone terribly wrong. Now, I want to remind you that the young girl was killed in the basement. The family was still in the house. How are you spending potentially an hour crafting a note? From my understanding, they were able to identify the paper that was located inside the house. That's how they knew it was likely written there. Now, for hours that morning, police treated the case as a kidnapping, not a homicide. They advised the Ramseys not to answer their phones, assuming the kidnapper might call and try to get their money. No one searched the entire house. They probably stayed in the living room with the Ramseys and the grieving family members and clergymen. Now, that decision was stupid. From my law enforcement experience, even if you assume a kidnapping or somebody runs away, the first place you look is inside the house. Lock the house down. Perform a search. Secure an area where people can grieve, but not contaminate potential evidence. That decision of failing to lock down the crime scene more than any other doomed this investigation. It wasn't until around 1 p.m. that Detective Linda Arndt suggested John Ramsey and the family friend recheck the basement. Oh yeah, we forgot. We'll do that now. Within minutes, John found his daughter's body in a small, windowless room behind a latched door. She was wrapped in a white blanket, tape across her mouth, nylon cord wrapped around her neck, with a broken handle of Patsy's paintbrush. From a forensic standpoint, what happened next is really painful to recount. Ramsey lifted his daughter's body and carried her upstairs, setting her down near the Christmas tree. He thought she might still be alive, but by moving her, he effectively erased the possibility of a clean crime scene. Fibers transferred, body position changed, blood patterns disturbed. I can't fault the father. I'm a father myself for wanting to care for his daughter and being in a state of panic, but that's why you have law enforcement officers to guide them. But the chain of evidence in this case, because the law enforcement failed to act, was absolutely shattered. The autopsy later showed two major injuries, a skull fracture and strangulation. The coroner ruled the cause of death as asphyxia by strangulation associated with craniocerebral trauma or head trauma. The order of those injuries has been debated for decades. My professional read is that the head wound came first, delivered with a blunt force object such as a flashlight, and that the noose around her neck was applied afterward, possibly to stage the scene or ensure the death. There were signs of prior vaginal irritation, but not a violent assault, suggesting either postmortem manipulation or a red herring to suggest sexual violence. Now, let me pause there. Though I'm guessing at the chain of events that occurred, as they seem most likely, if you were trained law enforcement personnel or a trained medical examiner, you would likely know what came first between livor mortis. Once you die, your blood settles in your body, starts to mark the skin. Rigor mortis starts to set in after several hours. The most enduring physical clue was a trace amount of male DNA on her underwear and leggings, graded partially, but definitely not from a family member. Forensics technology in the 90s couldn't do much with that kind of evidence, but it remains in storage to this day, waiting for the power of modern DNA to catch up. That tiny sample is the thread that could finally unwind this entire case. By the afternoon of December 27th, the story had gone national. Cable news found it as a perfect tragedy. Wealth, innocence, beauty, and the dark suggestion of deceit behind a mansion door. I was young at that time, but I remember watching the coverage and feeling disgusted. The media transformed the Ramseys into archetypes. Patsy, the controlling pageant mother, John, the detached businessman, Burke, the shadowy brother in the background. The press filled every silence with speculation, and the Boulder Police Department, inexperienced with high-profile homicides, couldn't get ahead of it. Inside the department, investigators quickly divided into two camps. One group believed the crime was domestic, a family cover-up following an accident. The other pushed for the intruder theory, citing the broken basement window and the possibility of the outsider's DNA. The division became toxic, and cooperation with the DA's office broke down. I've seen task force implode that way. When everyone's chasing a different ghost, the case file turns into a battlefield of egos. The parents did it. Theory gained traction fast. The ransom note looked too elaborate, and handwriting analysts claimed partial matches to Patsy's script. The paintbrush handle used for the noose came from her own art kit. Behavior analysts noted her composure on camera, calling it rehearsed. But as an investigator, I know grief manifests in ways the public misreads. Controlled emotion doesn't equate to guilt. Sometimes it's just shock, locked behind manners. Still, the circumstantial narrative was seductive. A child wetting the bed, mother snapping, an accident covered by an improvised ransom note. The problem is that no forensic evidence inside that house conclusively pointed to the Ramseys. No fingerprints on the weapon, no blood spatter matching their clothing, no physical link at all. What killed the investigation wasn't the lack of clues, it was the absence of discipline. The scene wasn't preserved, statements weren't synchronized, and the first 24 hours devolved in chaos. Detective Arndt later said she was left alone with the Ramseys that morning, unarmed, with no clear command structure. She described feeling unsafe, surrounded by potential suspects and uncertainty. When John carried JonBenet Renee's body upstairs, Marn said she knew the case was lost. That line has haunted me ever since, because every seasoned investigator has lived a version of that moment, the instant you realized you'd lost control of the truth. In early 1997, the Ramseys were defending themselves on television instead of inside the courtroom. Their cooperation with police became conditional. Lawyers present, questions pre-screened. Trust collapsed on both sides. In 1999, the grand jury reviewed the case and secretly voted to indict the parents for child abuse, resulting in death. But the DA refused to sign it, citing insufficient evidence. That sealed the public's perception. The rich had walked free. Forensics technology has advanced since then, but even as of 2025, the case remains open. The Boulder Police Department now claims they're working with outside labs to apply genetic geology to the remaining DNA fragments. John Ramsey, now in his 80s, says he's encouraged for the first time in decades. It's possible that one day, the same tools that unmasked the Golden State Killer could finally identify the unknown male whose microscopic cells have sat frozen in Evans for nearly 30 years. When I analyze the Ramsey case as a professional, I see less a mystery and more a cascade of preventable errors. Every misprocedure, every unchecked box, widened the gap between truth and theory. Once the case left the confines of the lab and entered the court of public opinion, it stopped being a homicide investigation and became a cultural test. People saw it and whatever confirmed their bias, parental guilt, media corruption, or elite cover-ups. That's what happens when the chain of evidence breaks. Conspiracy rushes in to fill the void. Every unsolved case breeds theories. But the Ramsey's investigation became a storm system all on its own. When law enforcement loses control of the narrative, someone else writes it for them. And that's exactly what happened here. The Boulder police let silence linger too long. And into that vacuum came a flood of speculation, amateur sleuthing, and sensational storytelling. I've seen it in other high-profile investigations, but never with this intensity. The world wanted a villain, and since no one was charged, everyone became one.
Are you aware of these different theories that are out there? Theories that you killed your sister, theories that your mother killed JonBenet, and theories that an intruder killed JonBenet. Those seem to be the three camps that people talk about.
Yeah, I mean, I know that we are suspects. I didn't know they were camps, I guess.
And these are people that post online. The shorthand is RDI, Ramsey did it, IDI, the intruder did it, or BDI, Burke did it. Do you know the theories that they set forth in saying that your mom killed JonBenet?
I don't know the details, but I know the ransom note, they think the handwriting match.
Have you seen it? Have you read it?
I don't think I've read the whole thing. I've definitely seen pictures of it, though.
Did the handwriting look familiar to you at all? Had you seen it ever before?
No. I feel like the listen carefully is very distinct, and I've never really seen that. I don't know. I've never really looked at it closely because I'll see it and kind of get taken aback, and it's not something I really want to look at, like, a lot, you know?
Right. Does that look like her handwriting?
She would always bug me about having good handwriting, and she would, like, make me rewrite stuff to try to get me to have good handwriting, and I think it's too sloppy.
The first and most endearing theory was that JonBenet, 9-year-old brother, Burke Ramsey, had something to do with her death. It's an ideal born from half-facts and childhood psychology, but it took on a life of its own. Investigators noted that Burke's fingerprints were found on a bowl of pineapple and milk left on the kitchen table. The same snack found partially digested in JonBenet's stomach. Some theorists claim she snuck downstairs, took some, and a scuffle broke out between the siblings, ending in a fatal blow to the head. The parents, realizing what happened, staged a kidnapping to protect their surviving child. I understand why this theory endures. It's emotionally neat, preserves the ideal of an accident rather than a deliberate murder, but it honestly collapses under scrutiny. The forensics evidence doesn't match. The head wound was far too severe for a 9-year-old's strength. The noose tied around her neck was tied with deliberate precision, a methodically two-turn knot called a slipknot choke, common in sexual homicides, not impulsive accidents. And then there's a ransom note, meticulous act of misdirection, far beyond a child's capacity. In law enforcement, we call that cognitive load mismatch. The behavioral profile doesn't fit the alleged perpetrator's developmental stage. Still, the Burke's theory resurfaced 2 decades later with the CBS docuseries The Case of JonBenet Ramsey in 2016, where experts reconstruct the evidence and suggested again that Burke might have struck his sister with a flashlight. CBS eventually settled a $750 million defamation lawsuit filed by Burke. That tells you something, not just about legal strategy, but about the reach of public obsession. A child witness turned into a pop culture suspect for the rest of his life, all because the real killer was never found. The second major theory, and the one that is most consistent with physical evidence, is the intruder theory. This idea will rest on two pillars: the unidentified male DNA on JonBenet's clothing and a broken basement window that appeared to have been used for entry. There were signs, vague but notable, of an outsider's presence. A shoe print from a high-tech boot near the body didn't match any footwear located inside the house or owned by the Ramsey. A palm print on the wine cellar door wasn't conclusively tied to the family. For many of us in the investigative community, this is the only theory that makes sense from a crime scene standpoint. The theory suggests that someone, possibly a stalker, possibly a burglar, entered the home late on Christmas night while the family slept, may have known the layout of the house, perhaps from a prior visit or from casing the neighborhood. It's been proposed that the intruder hid in the basement of a storage area, waited for hours, and then struck JonBenet when she was alone. The motive could have been sexual in nature, interrupted by JonBenet walking or resting, resulting in the fatal blow to the head. The killer then staged the ransom note and other elements to delay discovery. But the intruder theory isn't without its weaknesses. For one, there are no obvious signs of forced entry other than the single broken window, which John Ramsey himself admitted he had broken weeks earlier after locking himself out. There was no snow disturbance on the ground outside the window, despite a recent snowfall, suggesting no one came or went through that night. Fiber evidence from the basement matched items inside the house, but that could also indicate cross-contamination from the mishandled crime scene. Even the DNA, long held as the unknown male clue, could have come from manufacturing contamination at the clothing factory, a possibility modern analysts can't rule out. Still, this theory has the advantage of preserving one essential truth. The Ramseys never fit the psychological profile of family murderers. Their behaviors, though awkward under media scrutiny, were consistent with grief and trauma, not cover-up. I've interviewed guilty parents before. They don't fight for decades to open the investigation, to test DNA, or to face every camera pleading for help. John Ramsey has done all of that. Then there's the elite cover-up theory, the darkest branch of speculation. This one claims that JonBenet's death wasn't a random crime or a domestic tragedy. It was part of something larger, tied to child exploitation rings and powerful individuals. These narratives grew in the shadows of the internet forums in the early 2000s and exploded after the Jeffrey Epstein revelations decades later. They draw on vague coincidence, names and social circles, charity events, and political connections, and twist them into a network of evil. According to these theorists, the crime scene was managed, the ransom note was crafted by professionals, and Boulder PD was pressured to steer away from certain leads. There's no credible evidence to support any of this, but as someone who's seen how power and privilege intersect with law enforcement, I can understand why people believe it. The Ramseys were wealthy, socially connected, and immediately surrounded by lawyers and PR advisors. They were treated differently, even if unintentionally. The DA's office, hesitant to indict, the police were muzzled from speaking publicly. In a world already cynical about fairness, that looked like conspiracy. And once a case smells of privilege, the internet will turn it into a mythology. Which brings us to the strangest and most infamous myth of all, the Katy Perry theory. This one emerged around 2014, born not from investigation, but from internet absurdity. The claim was that JonBenet Ramsey never died and instead grew up to become a pop star named Katy Perry. The evidence was nothing more than visual comparisons, similar facial structure, childhood photos matched with Perry's adult features, and numerology, coincidence that makes even seasoned conspiracy theorists roll their eyes. Some posts even claim Perry's parents were secretly the Ramseys, living under new identities, and that their rise to fame was part of the elite rebirth ritual. Honestly, it's pure nonsense, but its popularity says something profound about the culture around this case. When the real story stays unfinished, people start inventing their own endings. The Katy Perry theory wasn't about belief. It was about participation. A generation raised on viral storytelling took one of America's deepest tragedies and turned it into digital folklore. It wasn't about murder anymore. It was about meaning. As a law enforcement veteran, I see the JonBenet Ramsey's case as a study in what happens when the justice system and the public imagination collide. Police work is slow, methodical, and bounded by evidence. The internet is. Theories travel faster than facts ever can. When the Boulder case lost narrative control, they lost the case twice. Once in the court of law, and again in the courtroom of culture. The truth is that every theory has a fragment of possibility. Maybe somebody in the house knows more than they said. Maybe the intruder's DNA really sat waiting in the evidence freezer, just a few years of technology away from exposure. Or maybe the answer is something far more ordinary, a chain of small mistakes that cascaded into one irreversible nightmare. Whatever the truth is, it's buried somewhere between science and story. And until the DNA sample tells us otherwise, we're left with a riddle dressed as a case file. A little girl in a Christmas home, a ransom note that reads like fiction, and a world still chasing ghosts through static. However, every case leaves a residue. The paperwork might be boxed and shelved, but something lingers in the minds of detectives, in the press archives, in the public imagination that refuses to let go. The Ramsey case never decomposed the way most files do. It fossilized. Every generation rediscovers it and polishes it again, trying to see their own reflection in its surface. From an investigative standpoint, the file should have gone to cold case detectives long ago. Evidence ages, witness scatter, memory becomes rumor. Yet the JonBenet Ramsey case remains alive, not because of what's in the evidence locker, but because of what's missing from it. The unknown male DNA, still too degraded for genealogy testing, has become both a symbol of hope and the perfect narrative device. It's a clue. It could solve everything, or it could be meaningless contamination. When I talk to younger investigators about the case, they always ask the same thing. What went wrong? The answer isn't dramatic. It's procedural. Crime scene control failed. Interagency cooperation failed also. And the investigative tempo collapsed under national pressure. In the field, we used to say that chaos loves confidence. Once the media declared guilt, the real trial died. Boulder PD was small, untested, and overwhelmed by the political and psychological weight of a child murder investigation under 1,000 spotlights. The FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit offered assistance. But by then, the local command had already entrenched its own theories. The file became tribal territory, not a shared pursuit of truth. The psychological toll on the family was incurable. Patsy Ramsey died of ovarian cancer in 2006, still insisting on her innocence. John Ramsey rebuilt what life he could, testifying, advocating for DNA reanalysis, pushing investigators who once targeted him to test the same evidence that could finally clear him. It's one of the rare instances where the suspect became the advocate for the investigation itself. An investigation that says everything about how distorted the case became. From a sociological view, JonBenet's murder marked a turning point in how America consumes crime. It was the first case of the 24-hour news era to fuse tragedy with entertainment. CNN, tabloids, and talk shows filled with airtime with speculation, body language analysis, handwriting comparisons, and pseudo forensics. Every expert with a camera became an authority. Every opinion turned into evidence. By the time real investigators tried to speak, the audience had already rendered its verdict. That transformation of homicide into a TV ritual birthed the modern true crime industry. Before JonBenet, the public watched courtroom dramas. After they watched investigations in real time. It created the illusion that every citizen could be a detective, that logic and intuition were interchangeable. The problem is that logic requires data, and intuition breeds the narrative. The case became a national test. Believers in institutional corruption saw cover-up. Believers in domestic dysfunction saw parental guilt, and those drawn to the occult saw ritual. As forensic science advanced, the investigation lagged. Touch DNA, familial matching, and genealogy-based tracking have solved dozens of cold cases from the same decade. Each new success, from the Golden State Killer to the Idaho College murders, reignites hope that JonBenet's killer will finally surface. Yet every time the lab revisits the evidence, they find the same limitations. Samples too minute, too mixed, too old. The Boulder Police in 2025 promised new partnerships with outside agencies, but optimism without breakthroughs becomes its own form of fatigue. The longer a case endures, the more it stops being about justice and starts being about belief. Entire communities online dedicate themselves to decoding the ransom note like scripture. Others pour over family interviews, frame by frame, convinced that guilt hides in a blink. This is where conspiracy steps in, not as a deliberate deception, but as a collective coping. When a crime resists closure, we invent closure ourselves. It's how the human mind resists helplessness. That's why the absurd theories, the elite cables, the pop star reincarnations persist. They're symptoms of a culture unable to tolerate uncertainty. A mystery without an answer feels like unfinished music, and the internet will hum the missing notes forever. As an investigator, I used to think facts could silence rumor. But in this era, rumor has become the medium through which people experience truth. What does justice look like now? For some, it's conviction, a name, a face, a mugshot. For others, it's a confession, even if whispered from the grave. For me, justice would be something simpler, a final alignment of the evidence with the story we tell about. Whether that comes from the new DNA hit or a dying declaration, I don't really care. I just want the noise to stop long enough to hear the facts again. Until that day, the case remains both artifact and mirror. It reminds us how easily empathy turns into voyeurism, how quickly analysis becomes accusation, and how a nation's grief can morph into entertainment. JonBenet Ramsey was a real child, not a metaphor, not an icon. She laughed, she performed, she lived 6 short years. Everything about that, the ransom note, the noose, the endless theorizing, belongs to us, not to her.
So it's been nearly 30 years since 6-year-old JonBenet Ramsey was found murdered in her family's Colorado basement, and the killer still has not been found. Retired homicide detective Lou Smith searched for an answer into his death in 2010, Now a team of his family and colleagues are working to try to close the case, and a new Fox Nation series got unprecedented access into the process. Watch.
There's a high probability they'll be the ones that solve the crime. They want to finish Lou's work.
I'm going out doing surveillance, grabbing DNA off folks.
We sent it to our lab, and then they test it.
DNA is a new field that's advancing rapidly. We've seen a lot of cold cases being solved.
The technology for DNA has come a long way since 1996. There's never been a better time to solve the case than there is today.
We're coming for you, and you will be found.
John Ramsey is the father of JonBenet, and is featured in JonBenet, The Killer's List, on Fox Nation, and he joins us now. Sir, thanks so much for joining the program. We appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
So, sir, you know, I've interviewed a lot of victims' families, and many of them, after years progressed, just want the noise to stop, and it's just too traumatic for them, and they don't give up, but they just want silence. You have taken a different route, and you have hope. Why?
Well, for two reasons. One, you know, the police control cases like this, the local police. We have lots of jurisdictions. And we've had a change of leadership in the Boulder police. Some of the, boneheads were dismissed. And we've got a new group running the place. And it's very encouraging. Secondly, DNA technology has advanced so much in the last 30 years. Lou Smith, the detective who was brought in by the district attorney early on, legendary detective, solved over 200 homicides in his career, said, John, this case will be solved by DNA. And I think we're at that point now, if we use the technology that's available.
So, John, let's actually play a soundbite of some of that new DNA technology, because there's a key piece of evidence that is yet to be tested. Let's watch it.
The only way that the case can be solved is through DNA testing of all the items of physical evidence, and most importantly, the garrote, which has never been tested, and it's an important item of physical evidence because it was hand-tied by somebody's fingers and then used to strangle JonBenet. That's never been tested for DNA, to my knowledge. I have gotten no assurance that it's going to be done.
And John, you think this is the key to solving your daughter's murder?
Well, the key is to be sure that we've tested all the crime scene evidence that was taken from the scene at the time. The other piece is that we need to use this new approach to using DNA to investigate rather than just to convict. You know, the DNA database that was set up by the federal government is 30 years old. It's advanced so far. There's a new approach called forensic genealogy research that is allows you to use vast amounts of DNA information to investigate the crime. And that's the piece that needs to be used.
John, what do you remember most about your daughter? I mean, I was 2 years old when this case took place, and as a criminal justice student, we always studied this case. So I didn't get to see it take place in the media. So tell me about your daughter, what you remember most about her.
Well, she was daddy's girl, and she really, she was very proud of the fact she was named after me, and I was, of course, proud of that as well. She had she was a very extroverted little girl, very up, the one memory I have of her is very vivid. I came home one day from work, and I must have had a frown on my face, and she came running up to me and said, Dad, I don't like that face. And I sort of put on a fake smile and said, okay, that's better. And she just was, she was a very up, energetic, very amazing little girl. And I miss her deeply.
Yeah, and you're still fighting to get her justice. John, we appreciate your condolences to you and your family.
Well,
and hopefully
thank you.
We can get some answers real soon.
In my career, I learned that some crimes don't destroy just one life. They fracture the collective trust between truth and those sworn to find it. The Ramsey case did exactly that. It exposed how fragile our systems are when pride, politics, and the media lens distorts the fundamentals of police work. It showed that even in a house full of lights, shadows can thrive if no one controls the switch. So what really happened on Christmas night, 1996? The evidence says one thing. The imagination says another. Between them lies the silence silence that defines this case. The silence after the ransom note, after the discovery, after the decades of interviews that all end with no comment. It's the same silence that hangs over every unsolved homicide file at the end of the day when the detectives shut off the lights and walk out. That silence is where the truth lives. And maybe one day, when science and honesty finally align, it will speak once again. Until then, we will keep listening. This has been Zero Signal Shorts, where the truth and shadow meet.